Have you seen the video, the story circulating primarily online, people before Profit TD's Roof Coppinger and Paul Murphy, they refused to answer a question from Gripped's journalist Ben Scanlon. It's all over the place. It's massive news from a relatively small opposition party, and it's great to see journalists from this county and around the country actually rowing in behind journalist Ben Scanlon, who two politicians refuse to speak to, which is lovely, isn't it? Thankfully, nothing like that would ever happen around here, which is good. And I'm sure if it did, there'd be loads of support as well. Right, Charlie McGettigan's a Eurovision winner. He joins us on the programme now. Good morning, Charlie. Thanks so much for your time.
You'll be glad to know I'll speak to you, Greg. Don't worry.
Thank you, Charlie, because I feel somewhat isolated and sad. No, hey, come here. You're among... And, you know, you spoke to me in a studio in Donegal Town. I used to do a show on a Monday night for Northwest Radio.
I remember it well.
And I have the tape. I have the tape. Oh, and I really... I must listen back to it, because both you and I, Charlie, were... Well, it was some time ago. Let's just put it like that.
Yeah, we were rookies. We were rookies.
We were rookies. But it was lovely at that time in your life to have that time with you, Charlie.
I remember that night so well. We visit Donegal Town quite a bit, myself and my wife. We're both originally from Ballyshannon. So Donegal Town is there. We do a little route. We do Ballyshannon, Rosnola, Donegal Town, and back to Ballyshannon. And we always do it two or three times a year. It's just a great place to visit, you know.
Lovely. Okay. You've joined scores of previous participants in demanding the expulsion of Israel from this month's Eurovision Song Contest. And I'll put the question to a government minister a little earlier on, Charlie. And it's not that he didn't want to answer the question, but he says, you know, what we really need to be focusing on is, you know, stopping the murdering of innocents and also getting aid into the country. And it kind of made me think a little bit that, you know, maybe we should be using our time to discuss that. But I suppose then I thought it's all part of the one thing, isn't it? It's all little things we can do to try and affect change.
Exactly, Greg. You know, when I was asked to sign the document, the letter, I signed it without caring. I just, this was, you know, it was right from my heart. And that, you know, like everybody else, you and me, and we sit down every night and watch our TV news and sort of see such dreadful things that are happening to the people of Gaza, their entire city knocked down. It's like something, it's funny, I was watching a documentary on the end of the World War, you know, VE Day last night, and there was a picture of Berlin post the war, and it very much mirrored what Gaza is like now. You know, I've been saying to people over the last couple of days that I draw the analogy that it's just as if during the troubles here, during the 30 years of conflict here, that the British government decided, yeah, well, we know there are IRA cells in Belfast, in Derry, so let's blow the whole place apart, and that'll surely... But I could imagine what that would have caused. So it's something very similar that Israel are doing in Gaza.
We can feel a little bit helpless in these situations, that we can't do anything. You know, we feel far removed, stories fall off the news cycles, and then something like this comes up, right? And it feels like, right, we can get behind it, and it might not necessarily affect change, but it's something that we can feel a part of in sending a message. Is that why this is catching on?
Yeah, I think my ideal situation would be that all the countries in the Eurovision this year would use their participation in the contest as a form of protest, you know, and to show solidarity with the people of... I mean, we've already shown solidarity with the people of Ukraine here in this country and in Europe, in that Russia were banned in 2022 were banned from the Eurovision Song Contest. I think, you know, it would help so much just that the people of Gaza would know that we feel for them, that we are concerned for them. And it would also give a message to the peacemakers, to people say, look, get together, let's sort this out. This is needless violence and needless genocide that's happened there.
The one thing, though, is when you go down a path like this is how far are you prepared to go, especially on a matter so serious? Let's say that Israel are allowed to participate in this competition. There are those in Palestine and Gaza that will look on and go, right, well, if you want to stand with us, then don't you participate with Israel? And that's how you follow this through to its end. So, like, we have to be careful that we're not a la carte protesters. That would be a concern I have. If you are behind the people of Gaza, well, then really I think you should be all in.
Yeah, well, in my opinion, there's two elements to this. There's the singers and songwriters who have entered the Eurovision. And it's a big deal, and it really does break my heart to have to talk like this, because Eurovision is something not only have I been involved in 1994, but way back to the 1960s, I've been a Eurovision fan. I love the idea of Eurovision, the coming together of all the countries involved, and, you know, a meeting of minds just to perform music and to entertain people. But it would be there's only so much you can do. You know what I'm saying? You have to sort of. If it was me, for example, Greg, I know that if it was me and the way I feel now I'm 74 years of age now, I'm a very, you know, I've accumulated enough of knowledge. But I feel that if I was in the Eurovision this year and Israel were in it, I would pull out, personally. Now, that's what I'm saying. I don't want to preach at other people and say, you should pull out, you know. That's each individual and each individual country has to make that choice themselves. Now, Kevin Backhurst has said that he is going to have a conversation with the EBU. And incidentally, I think the Director General of the EBU is a man called Noel Curran. And I think he has Donegal connections. I know that he has a house down in Creevy, just outside Ballyshannon. And, you know, I found him a very receptive person down the years anytime I spoke to him. And, of course, he's married to, I can't think of her name now.
No, that's okay.
The girl that sang for Ireland and won the Eurovision. God save us.
Well, it's not Donna. No, it's not Donna.
No. You hear her every time.
I know. It will come to one of us in the meantime. But Charlie, like, you talked about what you would do. Like, if it were me, what I thought would be an interesting protest, and then it might have sort of put more pressure on the likes of RT or the BBC or a French channel for that matter, for whatever, is the national broadcaster to mute Israel's performance, because it's achievable and it's within an individual nation's control. And I thought that would be a protest that wouldn't leave it open to sort of the kind of question I put to you about withdrawing from the competition altogether. You know, if their participation was muted, it probably might be more achievable and in a way might have more of an impact.
I've never heard that mentioned before. It's a really good idea, yeah. And then you could leave it up to each country if they want to use it or if they don't want to use it.
Precisely. And also it would not sort of leave question marks about people who might be opposed to Israel being in it but still taking part in it. I just feel it would be, 3 minutes of dead silence during an Israeli performance would send a very strong message and be less sort of morally questionable.
I think that is an absolutely brilliant idea. I hadn't thought of that. I wonder, have the powers that be thought of that?
I haven't heard it. I haven't seen it anywhere, Charlie. I just thought I'd put it to you.
And it also takes this whole idea. I know how much work goes into to entering the Eurovision Song Contest. And the last thing I want to do is to say to Ireland, sorry, you can't go in. We're right, you shouldn't go in.
Well, it takes the pressures off the writers and the performers, right? Because they've been building up to this their whole lives. It puts it into the control of state media, and they can maybe take a stand on behalf of the people that fund them.
Well, the National Union of Journalists have come out against this as well. They've sent a letter to Kevin Backhurst, and perhaps you're a journalist yourself, I'd imagine. You know, I would. If I was in your shoes, I would send that suggestion to the NUJ, and maybe that it would reach the powers that be.
Right, okay. Charlie, listen, thanks. Lovely to speak to you as always. I hope you and the family are keeping well.
Thank you very much. We're great. Thanks.
Brilliant.
Thanks.
Lovely, Charlie. Take care of yourself. Would you be in favour of that? As I say, it just feels like a compromise proposal that would be far easier to implement, and it would also really put it to RTE, like how... You know, what kind of a stand do you want to take on this? Because we can huff and puff, right? But the reality is that Israel's got a lot of friends. And we saw, as I mentioned earlier in the show, a time where there were previous calls for Israel to be banned and they went on to win it. Whereas I think individual countries could choose to take their stand, and it would put far more pressure on governments publicly funded media such as RTE to say, right, this is the stand that we will take. And it also means that artists don't feel that they're sort of morally bankrupt by competing alongside them. I just think it takes the light off them, which would be fair, given the fact that the Eurovision is a joyous competition and people go and they love it. And it's terrible when it's overshadowed politically. But as I say, that action from individual broadcasters, I think, would be what I would suggest. As I say, I haven't seen that suggestion elsewhere. I'm not taking credit for it, but as I say, literally haven't seen it anywhere else. Should RTE mute Israel? Now, the Camogie Association has announced that it will call a special congress on May 22 at Croke Park in a bid to resolve the controversy over players being forced to wear skorts rather than shorts. A vote will be held on the introduction of a rule to allow players the option to wear skorts or shorts. If passed, it will go into effect almost immediately. Lisa is manager of the under-18s Donegal and St Union's Camogie teams and joins us now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Greg.
It's one of those, isn't it, that is the issue the fact that you know, women feel more comfortable in shorts maybe than skorts, or is it about actually really in 2025, particularly women, being compelled to a dress code specifically? What do you think the main reasons for the pushback on this is?
Well, I think it's probably a mixture of both of them. You know, some girls like wearing the skorts, some don't. They find them very uncomfortable. And I just think in this day and age, you know, a lot of them as well think that we shouldn't be told what we have to wear. You know, LGFA girls are allowed to wear shorts. You know, why can't we? We're all supposed to be part of the same, you know, trying to keep the girls in sports and all. So I think it's a mixture of all sorts, really.
And are skorts uncomfortable? Like, what are they? It's shorts with
They're a skirt with shorts underneath.
Right.
They are uncomfortable. Mm. You know, you see girls spend most of their time on the pitch fixing them at them, and they're not great fit.
And I presume there's not the level of flexibility in shorts in skorts as there would be in shorts to fit all our different shapes and sizes.
No, definitely not. And they're not as widely available either as what shorts would be. But it's in the Camogie rules that the girls have to wear skorts, and if they don't, they can be put off the field.
And how pleased are you, Lisa, that the women standing up to this seemingly have effected change in relation to this? That there's been, you know, especially with a showpiece event, that the stance has been taken and the Camogie Association has had to listen?
I'm delighted. This has been an issue for quite a while. You know, it's not the first time that it's reared its head. It has been voted on numerous occasions at Congress. And it's not the girls. Well, my girls definitely haven't been asked if they want to wear them or not. So it's great that the girls that are on these highly prolific teams are standing up for the girls that aren't. I think it's brilliant. I really do.
And just given the makeup of the Congress, is it likely that girls and women will be given the choice? I mean, is it easy to guess what the outcome of that vote might be?
No, it's actually not. I'm kind of hoping that they do the right thing and let the girls choose whether they want to wear the skirt or not, or even come to a compromise. Like, I know the official team photos at the start of games, they look brilliant because all the girls are wearing the skirts and they look nice and tidy and all. But from a practical point of view, they are really unfit for purpose.
Yeah, and I suppose it's about the delegates listening to the players and those that support them, and that's how that vote will be carried. Holly is a player with Bert. Hi, Holly. Good morning to you.
Hi, how's it going?
So, Skortgate, how bothered have you been by this? And listen, on the wider scale of things, right? We know it's not insignificant, but it's not the most important thing in the world. But as a player, you know, how long have you been going? I wish I didn't have to blooming wear this skort.
Yeah, so I've been playing with the boys team since I was five up until under 13. And of course, there was no issue there. Got to wear my shorts and made the move to under-14s then. And all of a sudden, on the Camogie team, you had to wear a skirt and didn't know what the reason was. It was just the rules. But it's just very unpractical, as Lisa was saying. It can be really uncomfortable, and not everyone likes wearing them. Don't get me wrong, some players do like the look of them, but a lot of players don't like the feel of them, and it just thinks it's really impractical.
Is it possible,
and affects
Holly,
the performance of the players?
Yeah, do you think, and with all that in mind, do you think it's possible that, you know, if a choice is agreed, that more women and girls will play this sport? I wonder, is it so uncomfortable, or are people so uncomfortable in that type of clothing that they've stopped playing or don't play?
Yeah, 100%. Like, the skirt just doesn't accommodate everyone's needs. Mm. It doesn't fit everybody. So I think if players were given the choice, if the rules weren't so strict, it would just encourage more players to actually play the sport and take part.
And the one thing in all of this, Holly, and I'll come to you on this as well, Lisa, is that all of this press coverage and all this media coverage and all these conversations really should be about the game. What happens on the pitch, elevating it even higher than it is, encouraging more people to go out and cheer on women and girls playing Camogie, you know, rather than in 2025 talking about whether they can wear shorts or not. This should be driving, you know, the positives of the game, and that's on the pitch.
Yeah, 100%. The players' try should be number one in this. I think it should be more player-focused and more about the actual game, whether than what the player's wearing.
Yeah, Lisa, finally to you. You would agree this should be about really talking about the game and the amazing commitment of the athletes that take part and what they do on the pitch and the skill on show, rather than whether they're in shorts or not.
Oh, definitely. Like, the amount of girls that play Camogie is hugely less than what we play football, for example. Like, and I suppose there's no such thing as bad publicity, and it's great that Camogie is in the spotlight, but it's in the spotlight for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, definitely more player focused, and
brilliant.
Like, it is the fastest field game in the world, but you know, that's not what is being put out there at the moment. Mm-hmm. It's all about, oh, they should be wearing this, or they should be wearing that.
Okay.
Well, and it's not fair to the girls who are playing.
Yeah. Well, when all this is done and dusted, I would love either or both of you maybe to come back on, and we could have a chat about Camogie and how people could get involved in the sport and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, have to practice what you preach, and it'd be lovely if we could do a wee feature maybe on just the Camogie and not what people are wearing. I don't know if either or both of you might be interested in that.
Oh, definitely. I'm all about promoting the game.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
well, we'll get that sorted. Is that all right?
Yeah, definitely.
All right, brilliant stuff.
Yeah,
thanks,
brilliant,
Lisa.
Thank you,
Holly. Take care of yourself. Now, there's no guarantee that that motion at Congress will be passed. It's on May 22. The delegates need to listen to the women and girls playing the sport. They really, really do. Manus O'Donnell is involved in Camogie as a referee and coaching for 4 decades now. Hi, Manus.
How you doing, Greg?
I'm doing good. And you're backing those in this regard. You say, listen, they need to be listened to.
Well, I think it's been player-driven, and the GPA are listening to the players. So I think the association has to listen to the players, and it's what's going to promote the game for younger girls. And it's not really great publicity for the association issues like this. And unfortunately, I think it's been driven by the players. Now they must have a lot of frustration at the situation that was voted down last year at Congress. And I suppose they're putting pressure on, as the GPA now, they have the members of that. The GPA is pushing the views of the players. And at the end of the day, these ladies and girls are the people who play the game. Obviously, I'd never played Camogie. I played hurling. But the thing is that the players need to be listened to, and I think it's very important that it's great that they're going to have a special Congress now, and it'll be discussed at that. And it's important that the democratic process goes through that. the Congress, etc. And it's decided by the Camogie Association rather than by pressure totally from everybody else and from the media. The thing is that the players, but the ladies who are playing senior county Camogie, the majority of them have requested that they be allowed to play wearing shorts. So I think it's very important that be listened to.
Yeah, and that's it. And I suppose the delegates, whether they're traditionalists or whether they are progressives or actually really care what their players think, we'll find out. We'll find out on May 22nd. Manus, thank you. Maybe you might join us for a chat about Camogie, the actual sport of Camogie into the future.
Yeah, I would be delighted to.
Yeah, brilliant. It'd be lovely, actually. I'd love to do that. Get you in studio, what have you. We can have a cup of tea and a chat. Lovely stuff, Manus. Manus O'Donnell, involved in Camogie for over four decades, reffing and coaching, etc. A peaceful gathering is taking place this Saturday from the square in Clonmany at 1 p.m. heading towards Ballyliffin. It's in relation to the concerns that an iPass centre could open at the Strand Hotel. Another typical Irish Water spin. They mismanaged the lake in Milford and over-extracted and now taken from other areas that are also under pressure. 45 to 48% leakage of treated water. Unbelievable, Jeff. That's so... Almost half of the water that's fluoride's put into and it's cleaned out is unaccounted for. Imagine that still. I thought it might be down to 30% or whatever, but I think 45 to 48% we were told in the last interview. Still, unbelievable. Ishka Erin need to go out and fix burst pipes, says this listener. They need to be replaced rather than repaired. Sitting a computer and doing research is a waste of resources, in my opinion. But if that research feeds into the actual action on the ground, then it's not. But I take your point. A caller says, Eurovision is ridiculous. Australia is in the Eurovision. Sure, it's not even in Europe. Should we mute them too? Well, Australia aren't... killing 25,000 children with bombs supplied to them from America. Australia are camping it up and going over and singing songs on the stage. I can't see the equivalence there between Australia and what Israel are doing. The Eurovision is fun. It might be ridiculous. It's not for everyone, but it's fun. It's where people come together and sing and dance and prance on the stage and the audience love it. And, you know, in this day and age, anything that gives us a respite from India v. Pakistan, what's happening in certain parts of the world, you know, that's to be welcomed. There has to be light and shade. We have to allow ourselves to be happy and break our negative thoughts at times, or else life becomes very difficult to live. So why would you mute Australia just because it's not in Europe when you would mute Israel because of the genocide that they're a part of against the Gazan people? I don't see, but I take your point. Greg Hughes, all you need to do is go out and look at the sky and you will see perfectly the chemtrails happening in the sky as we speak. But are you talking about exhaust fumes for an aeroplane? Are you talking about something else? Please explain it to me what you're... And I'm genuinely not being smart here. But are you talking about just exhaust fumes that are eventually... Are you saying there is some... Are you saying it's a plan and there's stuff in them? Because there... Of course I can see the exhaust fumes from the aeroplane. A caller says, we haven't a politician apart from Padraig McLaughlin to speak up for the people of the Clonmany area. They should be ashamed of themselves. That comes in from Ava. Arshin says, always knew that water would be like oil in years to come, but this beggars believe these people are so out of touch. Milford and Fannard are now in a show, and Loch Doo was tampered with for concrete testing and the result is a leak with no local knowledge used. The result, Buncrana has no water, but does have a dam supplying the rest of East Donegal. Irish Water set up for privatisation, full stop. Does the water from the Eddie Fullerton Dam, is that pumped into Letterkenny now, or is that still in the pipeline, pun kind of intended? Because there was some concern. Remember that was up for grabs, was it seven, eight, 9 years ago? So is Buncrana water going into Letterkenny now, or is that still a pipe dream? Back with more after these. As we mentioned at the start of the programme, there's been a really worrying report, rise in reports of elder abuse, with complaints doubling since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic to more than 7,500 in a year. The government's being urged to widen laws on coercive control to include adults looking after their parents or older relatives, after the figures show that psychological abuse is the most common form of abuse against those over aged over 65. Again, I find this incredibly saddening, because older people can feel more vulnerable than other sections of society, and to imagine that in their latter years that that discomfort, that abuse is coming from maybe people charged with their care or who should be caring for them, is very upsetting, I find, anyway. Camille Loftus joins me on the show now. It is Camille, is it?
It is indeed.
I will do that, Camille. It's okay.
All righty.
I'm only messing. Camille Loftus, head of advocacy with Age Action. And Camille, you know, this is. Listen, it's good that we're getting the reports, because hopefully there's interventions and what have you. So the reporting mechanisms are working, it would seem. But then we are also talking about, you know, thousands of people in a very difficult situation, which we'd love to see not the case. What's your reaction to it, Camille?
I mean, it is extremely worrying, and it is really disappointing to see, in one respect, to see that people in the latter years of their lives are feeling afraid, you know, feeling pressured, feeling, you know, subject to abuse. The big takeaway I take from this is that child safeguarding, as it stands, you know, as a result of all the learning we did from the history of failures in child safeguarding in Ireland, that's now legislation. You know, there's a legislative requirement on anybody who deals with children to put in place measures to ensure that children are safeguarded. We have policies like that in relation to adults, but they're not on a legislative basis. And it really does make a difference, because if it's on a legislative basis, any institution, any organisation that's dealing with older people needs to have policies in place to make sure that you're trying to safeguard against any potential abuses, mm-hmm. and that you have really good responses in place when abuse does occur.
The abuse that we're seeing, is it in certain settings versus maybe in the home? Can we break down the figures in that way?
Well, we can, although, you know, one of the risks is that when people are at home, that abuse may not be recorded, yeah, as well. Yeah. So that's a factor to bear in mind. But I suppose what I would say is that, again, if we have these things on a legislative basis, then there is, and you can see that in relation to child safeguarding. You know, if you do any work with children now, you have to be screened before you do so. You have to be trained before you do so. You have to understand what the risks are. All of those things are in place as a consequence of there being a legislative basis.
Yeah.
But we don't have that same sort of basis in place in relation to older people. And I'd stress too that it's not only older people who are in need of this adult safeguarding provision, but obviously younger adults who have disabilities.
Yeah, vulnerable
are
adults.
Often very
with
vulnerable.
Vulnerability. Yeah, for sure.
That's right.
What when we talk of elder abuse, of the 7,500 that we're seeing in a year, what are we looking at? What is elder abuse in the context of the main complaints that are being received, or the main reports, sorry, that are being received?
I mean, we can see it cuts across quite a number of dimensions. I mean, it includes physical abuse, it includes sexual abuse, it includes financial abuse, which is something older people are particularly at risk for, and coercive control. So there are all of those dimensions present, and quite frequently, particularly if you are a person... before I go any further, I'll say, not all older people are vulnerable. Mm-hmm. We need to remember that. Mm-hmm. And there is a risk of sort of thinking that everybody, once they reach a certain age, becomes vulnerable. And in fact, that's not the case.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, for people who are vulnerable, particularly for people who have health conditions, who are maybe living on their own in more rural areas, who are living in institutions, there can be a real concern about speaking up and flagging that there's a problem. And that's why it's so important that we have procedures and policies in place so that we're not just reliant on those reports, that we have a proactive system in place which ensures that anybody who's working with older people is equipped and aware of what the risks are.
Yeah. So up until now, what are the mechanisms that are driving these reports? So in other words, how are these cases being identified, or is it people self-reporting? Is it that, you know, or is it people in residential care and their carers are noting family members are at certain stuff? So how at the moment is the system working?
So some of it will be self-reports. Some of it will be people, possibly family members, but not always family members, who, in the same way as one might with a child, see somebody and goes, something does not feel right there. You know, neglect, for example, is an issue in relation to safeguarding as well. And it can be staff in institutions who make reports around that as well, who might see, for example, an older person being pressured in relation to finances, perhaps by a member of their own family. So there's a number of dynamics by which reports can be made. But I think what we need is a much higher level of awareness. I mean, I think that one of the things that happened during COVID was that lots of people's eyes got opened to the kind of risks that older people can face. We know that things were not handled the way they ought to have been handled in long-term residential care, for example. So I think there's growing awareness around these issues. And I think older people themselves are growing more aware around these issues. But we need the legislative structure in place to make sure that we're doing things right and not just getting these reports, but that we're taking steps to ensure that the abuse doesn't happen in the first place.
Okay. Camille Loftus, Head of Advocacy with Age Action, thank you very much for your time. It's greatly appreciated. 086 60 25000 is the WhatsApp and text number. A caller says, RTE are muting everything else, so why not? I wish they would mute the Eurovision altogether. It's not about music anymore, but there's many other programmes on different channels. There's no such thing as Palestine. Israel has every right to defend itself against terrorist acts, believes the listener. Just because Hamas hides in schools and hospitals doesn't mean that Israel is to lay down and be destroyed. If the so-called Palestinians threw out the Hamas terrorists, they would not have a problem. So, I mean, that can be quite difficult for a vulnerable population to actually throw out a terrorist group, given the imbalance in arms and the fact that, you know, are you asking women and children to do this or what have you? So, I mean, let me ask you this. How many Palestinians is it okay to kill to capture one Hamas member? Let's just presume that the population can't rid itself of Hamas. You know, and maybe they see Hamas as the only defence from what's happening to them. How many Palestinians, what's the equation? Is it 20 to 1, 40 to 1, 15 children to 1? You know, if you believe that Israel has a right to defend itself, I'm sure there are other ways they could do it. You know, what is your ratio that's acceptable to you? Because at the moment it seems to be everything. Is Ben Scanlon a bona fide journalist? I wonder, will we see a number of so-called citizens journalists doing the round with certain agendas? Perhaps it's the times we live in. Ben Scanlon's a member, as GRIPT is, of the Press Council. And whilst GRIPT media approach certain topics, They're whether you agree with them or disagree with them, they are legitimate media and members of the Press Council and abide by the very strict same rules that we must abide by, albeit in it's a different type of media compared to radio. And I was actually trying to explain the press guidelines to people on social media yesterday, actually, in conversations. But he is a bona fide journalist. But the problem is he's also been a candidate in elections, but that's fine. So he is. So you might not agree with what Gripped or he might say or the questions that might ask. In this instance, the question he asked was a legitimate question. And the two politicians decided they didn't want to speak to him. And if all of a sudden it's trending all over Ireland, which, as I say, I'm glad for Ben to have that level of support. Everyone agrees with the humanitarian side of things with Israel. Do they agree with what the Palestinians are doing? Don't forget that they are the ones who started this. There are two sides to everything. But would you call, say, for instance, you know, say during the height of the Troubles, would you say the Irish were doing something, or would you say the IRA were doing something, as an example? It is somewhat different, don't get me wrong. But my point is you just say the Palestinians, what they're doing, but it's elements within Palestine that carried out that atrocity on October 7th. They should have been rounded up, hung, drawn and quartered for what they did to those innocent people. But we are quite some year on. And as terrible as the 1,500 deaths were in Israel, we're well in effect of 50, 60, 70,000 now. What is, and there's been collective responsibility to the entire population of Gaza. Isn't it ironic, says John, that amidst all the US commemorations, we sit day and night watching on our devices a massive concentration camp where the slaughter continues daily. This is orchestrated by the new Hitler and his cohorts and aided by the US and Europe. It seems unreal. It seems unbelievable. What on earth is happening? John, I agree. It's hard to get your head around that it's allowed to happen. You know, it really is unbelievable. Do me a favour, this evening when you go home, if you have oil heating or a neighbour has put your nose over the exhaust, and then come in tomorrow morning and tell us what, that jets are not polluting the atmosphere. They burn kerosene, basically heating oil, but unlike your oil burner, hundreds of thousands of times more. Yes, of course, it's terrible. And if that's what you're talking about, if that's what chemtrails are, right, I get you. It's massive exhaust pumping stuff out into the atmosphere. I would not like to do what you're suggesting. So I understand. I thought people were suggesting that there were chemicals being pumped out from aeroplanes purposely to control the weather. I know that happens in the United Arab Emirates to create rain, don't get me wrong. But I thought, sorry, the chemtrails were people suggesting that on an organised way, governments were either A, poisoning their populations, trying to control the climate or doing so. I didn't realise, as Lister says, it's about exhaust fumes. No, I wouldn't want to stick my nose anywhere near it. There was an expert years ago that concluded that the sun was being blocked out and that chemtrails exist. See, he had no way of proving it until 9/11, when no planes were flying over the US. No planes flew for 3 or 4 days, and this proved the air pollution. But why then do these planes have more or less effect dependent on the high or low pressure? That obviously then has to be factored in. Chemtrails, there are patents related to this going back 60 years. The aeroplanes that do this have separate tanks, okay, and dedicated spraying systems. Again, why has Ryanair not said anything about this, or Michael O'Leary, or Aer Lingus, or Putin, or Trump, or Kim Jong-ho? Like, how are all of these governments around the world complicit on this thing, with no leaks at all from anyone in a senior position saying that aeroplanes have separate tanks? How come staff at Boeing or Airbus aren't telling us, do you know we're putting separate tanks into these planes that they put the chemicals in? I will believe anything with a bit of evidence. But this caller believes that aeroplanes have separate tanks and dedicated spraying systems. Of course, they have they do this in Dubai. We know that they do cloud seeding. That happens in Dubai. I'm not sure it's done with commercial airplanes. I think it's actually dedicated equipment. Yes, cloud seeding is a thing. I get that. But people believe there are separate tanks in airplanes, and all governments and airport staff, plane manufacturers, the people working in the factories, they're all complicit in this, and no real evidence has come out about it. All right, interesting stuff. As has sort of been the trend with more recent good weather, we seem to be getting better temperatures in the west than they can expect in the east. Paula Coyle is Clinical Services Manager with Pieta Northwest and joins me on the show now. Good morning, Paula.
Good morning, Greg.
Right, now, darkness into light is soon upon us with dozens of events, hundreds of events around the country and dozens around Donegal. How significant is this as part of, I suppose, being able to maintain Pieta's level of service?
To be honest with you, Greg, the darkness and the light is vital for us to maintain our service. And yeah, you're right. I mean, there's so many walks taking place. It is our main fundraiser. It's taking place in 200 locations in 14 countries. So, you know, that's a bit of a global movement at this stage.
Because I think one of the biggest pushes, if I'm reading the marketing correctly this year, is yes, it's great if you go out and walk and what have you and talk about it and what, but registration is critical because that is where the money is raised.
Absolutely. So, you know, this year we are really kind of encouraging people not to just show up but to also sign up. It's an amazing experience, it's an amazing walk, and it is a lovely way, you know, to I suppose raise awareness and to show support. But reality is, for us, it is also our biggest fundraiser. You know, we rely on fundraising. We are reliant, actually, 87% of our annual income comes from community fundraising and donations. So we really have put our efforts into this year. We need, I suppose, the funds from darkness into light.
Yep, and people can sign up today. There's a special registration event in Letterkenny, is that right?
They can. There's still opportunities to sign up. So this evening in the centre here in Letterkenny, which, if anybody doesn't know where we are in the Grand Central Building, just across from Marks & Spencer's, third floor. We are here from 4 till 6:30 this evening for anyone who'd like to register. And the committee, our Darkness into Light committee, I'd love to have a special word of thanks for our committees, because without them, these walks, they wouldn't happen. You know, they wouldn't take place, and they're all volunteers. There's 13 walks in Donegal alone. So they're so committed, and we're so thankful to them. And the committee are having another registration event tomorrow evening from 5 to 7, and that's in Anne Danlin building at the ATU. And then, of course, people can sign up just before the event, but we'd really encourage people, if they can, to register before that.
Part in one of the walks outside Letterkenny, can you still register in Letterkenny, if that makes sense? Or if you're in Carrigart taking part in that walk, you register in Carrigart? I know you can on the day, but if you want to register in advance, it doesn't matter where you're actually walking once you've registered, does it?
It doesn't matter, as long as you let us know when you're registering which event you would like to go to, because we have them all over Bonkrana, you know, we have London Gudore, Rathmullen, they're everywhere. So as long as you let us know, we'll make sure that you're registered for the correct event.
All right.
And the one that's today, yes. Yeah. Sorry, it's this evening from 4 p.m. this afternoon. And we have a lovely special treat for the one in Letterkenny now. We have the Danu Young Women's Choir are going to do a sunrise concert for us at the event in Letterkenny as well. So we're really looking forward to that and very grateful to them.
All right. And when do the walks take place? Just remind people, the actual walks. Times for all of them, but it's over Saturday night, is it?
They all start at the same time, Greg.
Right, go ahead.
Every one of them. Yeah. So it's Saturday the 10th of May at 4:15 a.m.
Okay.
So effectively Friday night into Saturday morning.
Lovely stuff.
Because sometimes it can be a bit confusing.
No problem. Thanks, Paula. Paula Coyle, Clinical Services Manager with Pieta Northwest. If you want us to mention your walk in your area, get in touch with me and we'll do it over the course of the next few days, just by way of encouraging people if they wish to get involved. I know it's not for everyone, I understand that, but it is for a lot of people as well. Is there a statute of limitations for reporting elder abuse? If if a person is deceased and you discover wrongdoing and bank statements back up the abuse, can a legal case be taken? I'm not sure if that would fall under the auspices of what we're talking about. Obviously, the question came a little bit late. It's about proving it. That sounds to me like potentially a criminal matter rather than elder abuse. It sounds to me like it's financial abuse of an elder person. And if you've got evidence of that and there's a misappropriation of funds, I don't think that would necessarily... I mean, contact your local Garda station, but it might not be the elder abuse we're talking of. That sounds like sort of, you know, potentially financial abuse or fraud, which I'm not sure in terms of statutes of limitations. Can I ask a question in regard to elder abuse? Can I be asked if an incident of elder abuse, has it ever been reported by a third party that then becomes completely false? Thank you. Well, it's like everything. Something has to be proven. When we talk of the 7,500 reports of elder abuse, that doesn't mean that all of them are actual cases. There could be third parties who've made false allegations. I'm not sure how they're processed. So inevitably, like anything... not every single one of those reports is going to be legitimate. You will get some people, you might get a family member that makes the allegation against another family member because there's some sort of a dispute or what have you, and their motives might be questionable. So inevitably, of course, that has to be the case, doesn't it? That sometimes there's going to be abuse of that system. Just on terms of fundraising, I wanted to mention a charity auction. It's on Saturday, May 17th. It's at Logues of Cranford. It starts at 8 p.m. And it's raising funds for the Irish Cancer Society as part of Relay for Life, Team Oran, in memory of Oran O'Donnell also. And if you want to donate items for that auction, and I can see sheep here, I can see round bales, stuff like that, or any machinery I'm sure they'd be very grateful for. We have a series of mobile numbers here. There's absolutely no point me reading these mobile numbers out because you wouldn't have a pen handy. But get in contact with us if you want to support that. Right, that's where we have to leave it on the 9 till noon show for another Thursday. We're back tomorrow morning, Friday morning, with a Friday panel and lots more besides. But for today, a big thank you to Caroline Orr, who researched and produced the show, assisted by Shannon Wilkins. And for me, Greg Hughes. Chat to you tomorrow morning at 9.